Welcome to our Conscious Relationship Seminar Series. I'm David Steele, founder of Relationship Coaching Institute, and you can check out our resources for singles and couples. We got free audio programs. All of these programs are recorded and available to you. So go to www.consciousrelationshipresources.com to check that out. Today we have Don Ferguson, PhD, who is going to talk with us about reptiles in love, ending destructive fights and evolving towards more loving relationships. Don is from Madison, Wisconsin. He's clinical director for psychiatry at the Dean Health System, a major healthcare provider there. And he has been developing this material and presented it to literally hundreds of groups of psychologists and psychiatrists. He does trainings. So now he has a Reptiles in Love program. It is well-researched and has been helpful to many, many couples. And I'm really looking forward to what all the excitement's about, Don. I enjoyed meeting you at Smart Marriages, by the way.
Yeah, it was great to see you there.
Yeah, and Don's material is very well-received. Today, you will learn how the brain affects couples' abilities to talk and really hear each other when they're fearful, angry, or hurt, how to lower the emotions and intensity before trying to fix things or trying to get closer, how most repetitive battles are about the wrong subject. Don, I just have to know more about that one. And you will learn mechanical approaches to lowering anxiety and calming each other so that you can have more productive, loving discussions and relationships. So welcome, Don Ferguson.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. Great.
So, Don, why do you call your book Reptiles in Love? What is the reptiles part about?
Well, let's dive right into that. The reptiles in love has to do with the reptilian part of the brain. And I think a lot of times people think of their brain as one functioning organism, and they don't really think about it being compartmentalized. But the reptilian part of the brain is the most primitive part of the brain, the smallest part of the brain that developed very early on, and it has to do with basic functioning of the body. It keeps the blood flow going, oxygen going, and in that part of the brain is a part called the amygdala, an limbic system which responds to emotions and fear and fight or flight responses, meaning that when we're threatened, such as if someone were about to hit you or if you were in a car accident or if something else was threatening your safety, you would go into what's called the fight or flight response, which is the body's defense in which everything else is geared. Everything in the body is preparing to run away or to attack or in some way to defend the organism. And it's all for maximum efficiency. The breathing goes more shallow. The blood flow is restricted close to the heart for maximum efficiency. Muscle groups tighten up. Cortisols are released into the brain. Adrenaline's firing all over the place. And this is a massive body response. And the brain is doing something very sophisticated at this moment. In just the tiniest bit of a second, the brain goes to the most efficient place of self-defense, in which it virtually stops functioning on such things as empathy and organizational skills and verbal skills and all the stuff that you think of as making you a person, makes you good at your job or makes you a good parent. All that stuff is right out the window, and instead you go into this mode of needing to defend yourself or get away.
This part of the brain, if I recall, it's about the size of a walnut, like really at the base of the brain.
The amygdala actually means almond, and it's shaped a little larger than an almond.
Our entire brain is like bigger than a grapefruit, so you're saying that this one little tiny part of our brain overrides everything else?
Yes. You'll see blood flow changes towards this, and much of our reaction is going down into this area, a very small part of the brain. Now, I shouldn't say that everything's like totally shut down, but the lion's share of the work is now in this protective device that has one goal. This is a miracle. The goal is to protect you. Care much about anything else.
Yeah, and that's not just with physical danger. That's like if you perceive emotional threats too, right?
Well, I think that's the surprising thing is that when you talk about arguing with a loved one, you don't think of that like a car accident or a physical fight or violence. And yet it has some of the same qualities. When you think of the most important person in your life or the person that you feel like you're in love with or should love you, suddenly saying things that sound very unloving, that kind of betrayal seems to send us right into that same thing, and that's why we fight with loved ones in ways that we never fight with coworkers or people on the street. We actually end up treating loved ones worse than total strangers.
Yeah, I imagine that's where violence comes from, you know, as well.
Certainly.
Yeah.
It's the proximity and also that sense of just total arousal in which you find yourself doing things that don't make sense. Let me give you an example. Probably everyone had a moment when they were arguing with a loved one, and they started off saying, let's go out Friday night. And then all of a sudden they were saying, well, we don't have any money, so we can't go out because you spend all our money. And then they start talking about, well, if you had a better job, and then the other one would say, if you quit nagging me, I would have a better job. And then they're off to each other's parents being jerks. And before too long, they've rolled in 18 different discussions, and they think they're having an argument, but really, they're not. They're completely off target. And if somebody watching them would say, my gosh, which argument are they having?
Yeah.
When you're in the middle of that kind of thing, you actually think you're having a very intelligent conversation, perhaps, or you feel like you're saying very, very bright or self-defending things, but from the outside, really, it's garbage.
Now, you said they're really not having an argument, so what would you call what they're doing?
They're having a fight. And I guess that's important to delineate, that the old saying that couples fighting is not really bad and people need to have a good fight now and then. I absolutely disagree, because my definition of a fight is when you do these kind of harmful, attacking, fleeing kinds of things. A good active discussion, a debate, or whatever you want to call it, where you stay on target, where you organize your thoughts, where you actually have a targeted goal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the discussion. In this random fighting, the goal is really to defeat the partner or to get away from them. And you can tell that also by the times when people will whip out dictionaries or will try to prove their partner wrong. In the office, I hear all the time, I wish we had a videotape of that fight. I'd show you what you really did.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't make any difference at all.
Yeah. So an argument is on topic, and it's to discuss something you might have a difference of opinion about. And a fight is just trying to protect yourself and trying to win over your partner. And basically, it's you're feeling threatened.
Right.
During a fight, yeah.
And again, the reptilian brain, the reptilian portion of the brain does not have the power, it doesn't have the skill to empathize, it doesn't have the skill to have introspection. We know actually now with brain scans, we can see that when you stress out the brain to a significant degree, a little strip of the brain that has to do with new learning and self-observation actually shuts down. You see almost no electrical firing in it. And when you think about that in terms of how people are trying to talk to each other in a marriage, and you realize that their self-observation, their ability to look at themselves and say, wow, the next thing I'm about to say isn't very smart, is gone. And their ability to learn new information and take in new data and go, wow, that's a new idea, is gone. Then you know that they're not really having a discussion any longer.
Yeah, you know, what occurs to me is that that's the part of the brain that evolves last.
Right.
And when we're growing up, the part of the brain that is developing self-awareness and, you know, emotional maturity, that develops last. And in an argument that becomes a fight, that's the first part to go. So it's like, you know, last in, first out. Another way of putting it is the reptilian brain has seniority.
Exactly. This has to do also then, I mean, we don't have to get all that complicated, but when you think about early learning is stored in a very primitive part of the brain as well, known as the hippocampus, which is right back there by the reptilian brain. So old learning or things you learned as a child as ways to defend yourself usually stick with you through life.
Hmm.
Now, the other thing about this is that verbal centers in the brain are low in the brain as well. And therefore, your mouth can be running, you can be talking without your brain attached. And that's the experience that many people have, is that they're actually saying things that a little part of them is saying, oh my gosh, this isn't going to go very well, right? But they just can't stop.
Hmm. Yeah, I can really understand how things can get out of control. And I don't quite understand why, you know, we're such evolved beings, and, you know, why this primitive part of us can just overtake us so easily. But that's just a fact, you know. You don't really have to explain it. It's just what happens.
It's a miracle in a way, and in a way, you still want it because, for example, if you are threatened, if you're physically threatened, or if you're in a car accident or something, you certainly don't want to have higher thinking. In a car accident, you want to slam on the brakes and respond pretty automatically. You don't want to be suddenly thinking, well, why did that driver do that? Or, you know, well, that's a nice song on the radio. If I survive the crash, I'm going to write that down. You really want this part of the brain to activate, but it has its downsides, and particularly in communication where two loved ones are really trying to figure something out and they just can't get back to it. I work with a lot of couples, so I see this obviously on a daily basis, where couples really are not uncaring. They don't hate each other, and yet they say these terrible, terrible things to each other and just can't seem to slip back out of that gear.
Yeah. Do you know how universal this is? Do some people just have better self-control? They never argue, they never fight, they're always under control, or is that just a myth that, you know, everybody, you know, slips into this?
I think everybody has the potential of slipping into it. Certainly some people seem to be better monitored than others, although I got to tell you that some people that appear to be doing better at this, who have just shut down with each other, are actually harder to work with. In other words, in some ways, they're in the flight response. So I've worked with couples that just didn't talk to each other at all. They didn't fight. They didn't show up on the screens. They didn't show up on police blotters because of their loud fights. They just didn't talk to each other.
Mm.
To some degree, those are harder to work with because they've literally flown into a state in which they just don't challenge each other at all. Those couples, I fear, in couples therapy, an inexperienced therapist may tell them, well, they've got to learn how to go out and have more fun, they've got to have more sex, they've got to get closer. And actually, that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. That couple has slowed things down, slowed their heart rates down, and feel safer, just like the loud ones do.
Yeah, so those couples that are just so conflict avoidant, the worst thing in the world would be to have an argument. Yeah, so I never thought of it that way, that you know they're just walking around afraid all the time.
Right. And that kind of takes us to a basic premise of this treatment. In traditional couples therapy, and I see it a lot in self-help books, there's a lot of language around getting people to be nicer to each other, get closer, touch each other, be intimate. And I go exactly the opposite direction. My belief is that too early to encourage people towards closeness is actually to physiologically raise their heart rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can actually be worse, and they can be made worse instead of better.
Right. You don't want to do something that stimulates the fear.
Right.
And so earlier you talked about slowing things down. Can you talk more about what you mean by that?
Right. A lot of times the reptilian brain will be telling you that you need relief. So if you've been really hurt by a partner, let's say your partner's had an affair, you may be feeling like, I need big answers. I need to know that they're never going to do this again, and I need all my answers and all that. And often with that kind of overstimulus, you and your partner will even get further apart. A lot of times the first goals are not solving the problem and not necessarily getting more intimate, but just slowing things down and developing a sense of safety. And a lot of times what I'm talking about with that is basic rules of how you're going to talk to each other, commitments that you're not going to leave each other, even for 3 days or whatever. In other words, kind of small, minimal interventions that at least let you know, okay, for a couple of days I can breathe deep.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. When I do an intake with people, they are usually reptilian. In other words, they're coming in and telling for the first time their entire marital story to a total stranger. And that's a terrible event in some ways. I feel bad for them, but I still do this work. And at the end of the session, they may feel like, oh, we're investing this time and money, and we should go home and we should work on our marriage. And I tell them their first assignment after seeing me the first day is nothing. They need to go home and talk about whether I'm the right guy to work with is all.
Hmm.
They should do nothing on their marriage for the next week until we meet again. And when I say that, you would think they might be kind of frustrated with that. Invariably, I literally see their shoulders drop and they relax.
Hmm.
That there's a week when they don't have to try to fix themselves.
Hmm. So the message I'm getting is anything that we can do to create safety between them,
right,
helps them settle down, calm down.
Right. Relatively small agreements and beginning to help them self-examine. Now, here's another important principle of this work, which is that all successful couples therapy, in my view, is actually individual therapy.
Yeah, I've heard that many times, actually. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that couples come in thinking that the goal of therapy is to fix their marriage or to stay together at all costs, or many do. Or others come in saying, look, I'm halfway out the door, I don't even know if I want to stay or not. And a part of them is afraid you're going to try to talk them into something that's not good for them. When you take the approach that, first of all, their own health has to get better, and that the goal of the relationship will be that you have two healthy people begin, which then will allow them to be better lovers, or at least to make better decisions, again, you see them relax a bit. And so the goal is not necessarily to glue them together, or mush them together, as I say, but really to get them to where they feel confident as individuals. I find most divorces are kind of stupid, really. They're for bad reasons. And often when people are able to listen to each other and think more clearly and begin to think about their own needs and think of what they bring to the table, so to speak, also what their part of the fight is instead of just what the partner does to them. As they develop that sense of health, they're actually able to engage much more readily in a relationship and really look at intimacy.
Mm. Yeah, and divorce is about running away, and I've seen lots of folks that they just can't stand the heat. They just need to get out of the kitchen no matter what, and that's a flight response. So exactly. The goal is to create comfort and safety. What are some other ways that couples can do that?
Before I go to that, one thing I do want to say about that is that initial goal is to create safety.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're actually building towards is that they then can, it's almost the reversal, is that they can then tolerate the anxiety of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the anxiety of being clear with each other and approaching these needs. So the it's not all about calming and relaxation, but the initial goals is that they first assess themselves. So the first step in this work is to get them to begin to assess their own lives. Are they healthy? Are they having headaches? Are they sleeping? Are they having any clinical symptoms such as depression or anxiety? How's work? Basically having them review with me or on their own or some combinations. I'm switching a little bit because I do this both in individual and group work and retreat, but you want to get them to first self-assess in terms of just how they're doing as people. Where are all the stressors coming in from?
Mm-hmm.
Is it all about the marriage, or is really the lion's share of it coming from work, and marriage is just where it gets acted out?
Mm, yeah.
I also then have them review their family histories, and what we talk about there is that that's not a psychoanalytic approach of trying to get them, you know, blame everything on your mother or it's because of breastfeeding, but it's really to think about culture and where they learned, what they learned, how they learned to defend themselves. The first step is really kind of getting them curious about themselves, even more than about the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And as they hear their partners doing this, and people can do this on their own, you try to get them to raise their curiosity about themselves and their partners. Then they can go into a mode, and this is getting more to your question, David. What we try to get them to do is narrow their fighting styles down into a little more manageable bracket. With fight or flight, people tend to do kind of a hit and run with each other. Let's say they've got a money problem that every time they talk about it, they get into a fight. And before too long, one is sitting down to watch TV, their favorite show is on, and all of a sudden the partner's standing next to them with a stack of bills. And before they can even answer, their blood pressure skyrockets, and they can tell they're ready for a fight.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to get them to schedule meetings, and I typically ask people to do half-hour partnership meetings, and a half hour is just because that's about how long humans can concentrate before they get a little screwy. Within those meetings, I ask them to do a lot of planning around what kind of meeting it should be. How long should it last? 30 minutes is average, but I've had a lot of people say, look, we can't even do that. We need to do 5 minutes, and that's just fine. What you find is that when people go into a meeting like that and they know what the subject is, today we're going to talk about what to do with this money that we've got in under the pillow, or this week we need to talk about sex. Really, even sex should be done in a partnership meeting, not necessarily in the bedroom. Then they have an assignment and they're more likely to stay on track. Finally, I ask them to choose the place to have it. Often, couples should have this like at a dining room table where they can sit comfortably and have a pad of paper in front of them. I often encourage people to write. For one thing, it forces the brain to organize a bit, and that's a higher brain function, is organizing skills. But also, we know that just doodling or knitting or whatever can actually calm you a little bit. So some people, even if they're just doodling, may be a little calmer with a pad of paper in front of them. And then finally, the pad of paper is to help them organize what they're trying to finish by the time the discussion is over. And often I'll ask them to put a line down the middle of it and have column A and column B. Column A is the subject that they're starting to talk about. And then column B is all the extraneous stuff that's going to pop into their heads. So maybe they want to talk about where to go for vacation, and that's what they scheduled the meeting for. And then all of a sudden one of them says, oh, you know, we can't go on vacation because you spent all of our money again. Well, that's no longer a vacation discussion. That's a finance discussion. And you need to know consciously, do we really want to talk about finances or do we want to talk about vacation? So a lot of this is really just trying to push them towards being conscious about what they want to talk about, as opposed to in a very unconscious way. I love the title of your program, in fact, because of that reason. In a very unconscious way, they go on to all these different subjects, and at the end they go, you never listen to me. We can't have a discussion at all.
Right. A lot of what you're saying, you know, making the appointment and having a place like the kitchen table and keeping it on topic and using paper and writing things down, you're creating structure. And there's much more safety and productivity and structure. And of course, the damage comes from being, you know, unstructured and chaotic, and everything in the kitchen sink gets thrown in. So if they can just take the initiative and decide on and implement a structure, then they're halfway home.
This takes some practice. What I'll tell them is that you need more structure at the beginning, but you don't always stay with it. Initially, people need a lot of predictability. And like I say, I've had couples that were so volatile with each other that they said right off the bat, I can't do it for more than 5 or 10 minutes. So we had them set the egg timer and do a 5-minute meeting. And generally, within a few weeks, they're up to 15, 20, 30 minutes pretty easily. First, they have to have some sense of predictability and safety.
Mm-hmm.
Just a note on that is a lot of times couples won't talk to each other because they don't trust each other. Not in trust in the sense of hurting each other, but in the sense of, if we bring this up, we'll be talking for 4 or 5 hours, and then you won't talk to me for 3 days after that. So why would I want to start that?
Mm, yeah.
And so when you can do something like this and really stick to it a couple times in a row, where you can really say, oh yeah, we committed to a half hour, we did the half hour, it wasn't horrible, we didn't get it all done, but we got a couple of little agreements. Quite often people go, okay, you're trying. Yeah, I can tell you're trying. So a couple of little success experiences can go an awful long way.
And then do you give them communication techniques? I hear all the time that, you know, you don't communicate, or you need to communicate better, or you need to learn how to communicate, or teach me to communicate. And I say, well, you know, you're communicating all the time, you know,
right,
even without talking. But do you have specific communication tools that you teach them in addition to the structure?
Not a lot of them. Actually, I try to dig that out of them. I know a lot of people use active or reflective listening. Research is not strong on people continuing to use reflective listening after therapy ends. So I try to dig something out of them. What often a person, you need to ask yourself, if you're a partner and your partner doesn't want to talk to you, is there anything I do? And in fact, ask them, is there anything I do that makes you not want to talk to me? And what you find when you start asking that question in a couple of different ways is often partners give each other signs that the fight is going to be on.
Mm.
And they know each other, even for a little bit of time, they begin to pick up on those signs really quickly.
That is a great question. Is there anything I do that makes you not want to talk to me? Is that the question you just asked?
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow, what a great question. It just really struck me.
Yeah, I think it's very helpful, because a lot of times people can rattle it right off very quickly. You roll your eyes when I say certain things. That makes me feel stupid. It's the same thing my father did. Or you, every time I bring this up, you smirk or whatever.
Mm.
One of the things that's important about this is that often couples come in saying, we're ignoring each other, he doesn't care about me, she could care less if I live or die, I'm just a paycheck to her. And I find that just exactly the opposite is true. In other words, they're so revved up with each other that they're actually in a state of what I call marital paranoia. In other words, it's not that they're ignoring each other. If they could ignore each other, they probably wouldn't be in my office. They'd be home ignoring each other. They're so revved up with each other that they purposefully have to stay away and flee and not listen, and yet they're very watchful of each other.
Hmm.
Now, we know, for example, just as an example of this, we know that the right side of your brain interprets facial gestures. So you look at a face, and it takes 30 to 40 milliseconds to interpret a face. So you walk into your kitchen, and I get couples all the time that can relate to this story. They drive home and they think, I'm not going to do it tonight. I'm not going to do it tonight. I'm not going to do it tonight. No way am I going to do it tonight. They walk in the kitchen, they look across, they see their partner's face, and something about the face tells them that there's stress or it's been a bad day or whatever. And in 30 to 40 milliseconds, they tell themselves a story. Here we go again.
Hmm.
And we also know that danger signals are routed directly to the amygdala. They don't go through the neocortex at all. And so without even thinking, hey, maybe she had a bad day today, or maybe she has a stomach ache, or whatever, maybe she has gas, you go straight to, oh, what's she on about now? And that glimpse of a second, she looks at my face and sees my face go down and one lip go down, and she goes, oh, here we go again, and boom, we're in a fight and we haven't said a word.
Hmm.
We have not yet said a word, and we're already in battle formation.
Wow.
So a lot of this stuff happens so instantaneously, and people are so aware of each other that when they say we're ignoring each other, just exactly the opposite is true.
Right. Yeah. And early on in graduate school, I learned the word enmeshment, so it sounds like what you're talking about. They're enmeshed with each other. They're so over-involved with what the other is thinking and what they might do. When you're anticipating what they might do, then you're restricting what you might do because you don't want to cause what they might do.
Right. Yeah, you'll remember the master, Murray Bowen, talked well about how people could just seem fused together. And the fusion is not a healthy, loving connection. Or, you know, he talked about people being stuck or fused, and it was not a healthy kind of loving situation. It was more like a dramatic glue that made them feel trapped more often than not and reactive to each movement.
Yeah.
And that's why I say the goal then is really a healthy individuation, a healthy pulling away and being yourself, being healthy within the relationship. And invariably, people can be better lovers if they can reach that goal.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong with where you're coming from with this, that they don't need to learn any fancy communication skills. They basically need to create safety to not have their fight and flight response be activated. And when they're coming from their adult place, they can, of course, have a discussion. So they don't need to learn any fancy communication skills to do that. They just need to create the structure and the safety just to talk. They know how to talk.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that's cool. You said something earlier that I want to follow up about. You said the anxiety of intimacy.
Right. Right.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think a lot of times we think of intimacy as sensuality or sexuality or being close and being happy. But real intimacy is also being able to be honest with each other, being able to challenge each other a little bit, being able to deal with subjects that are uncomfortable or make us want to run out of the room. And really to get there requires a great deal of trust. And when trust has been broken for whatever reason, and when you get right down to it, we always betray each other in relationships. Small ways or large ways, we always disappoint each other in some manner. The ability to come back from that and tolerate the sense of danger and can I trust you again, that requires a great deal of rebuilding trust in tiny little ways. I used the example earlier of an affair. People want guarantees. They want to know that they're going to be safe. They can't afford to ever feel as bad as that again. And yet there are no guarantees. And the quicker you can move them away from that, or move themselves away from that and towards the point of how do I make myself feel a little safer? Do I need my partner to call me every evening when they're going to be even 10 minutes late? Do I need my partner to reassure me in some other ways? How am I going to know my partner really loves me and only me? Those questions will give them much more mileage than I need a guarantee or I need to know that you're absolutely never going to do this again.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you think it's true that for pretty much everybody, intimacy is anxiety-provoking in ways?
I think to some degree, yes. I think it's more so for people that have actually run into a brick wall or have struggled with their relationship. But no, I think for everybody there's at least some risk or challenge involved, some building of trust, and that creates in itself some degree of anxiety. And it may be in different ways for different people. For example, one couple may find that they can talk about sexuality very easily, but they get totally flustered and out of control when they try to bring up money or they bring up children or parenting or something.
Hmm.
So it may be in different subjects. One of the things about this is that anxiety is different for every single person. It's so that the way people will respond or what they'll feel anxious about is totally individual. The nice thing about that is if you can get couples to recognize that, they can feel less blaming or weird because they have a particular need or a particular anxiety.
Or a button, you know, everybody has their buttons.
For example, a lot of times couples will get very overly involved with each other. They often take a great deal of responsibility on for each other. So if you have a partner who is unhappy about something, even if they're not blaming you, you may still feel kind of desperate to make them happy again, to do something for them. And the more intense that feeling becomes, you see this a lot in families where one of the partners has depression, the more they don't get better or they don't seem happy, the more desperate you become. Often you get angry at them.
Yeah.
In this goal, you're trying to get them to not take so much dramatic responsibility on for each other, and really instead to be safe enough, confident enough to actually hear their anxiety. You can actually do quite a bit for a person if you're not feeling personally responsible for them.
Right. You know, in your description of the book and your seminar today, you make the statement that help couples sort out real from unreal issues. And now this is just fascinating to me because I've worked with lots of couples where each one is just absolutely convinced that their opinion is a fact. And you make me feel so angry, you know, all that kind of stuff. How do you help couples sort out real from unreal issues?
That's a good point and finances is maybe a good example of that. Most of the couples that I've seen, I'm sure you've had the same experience, when they come in and they say, we're having fights about money all the time. She spends too much. She doesn't care about us. She's always spending a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask them a series of questions about money, how much is too much? How much is it safe to spend each week in your family? How much money do you need in the bank at the end of the month in order to feel good? What are you saving for? What are your retirement plans? If you go right down through the list, quite often they can't answer one single question that's business-oriented, meaning that money is not the issue. Money almost always has to do with autonomy and power and trust and affection and do you really care for me? Do you really care about the family? And terrified of being poor. And often you have to get to those very real subjects. And when you start to ask couples very specific questions, such as how much money would you feel good about having in the bank at the end of the month, quite often they're not that far off.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start getting very specific about how much is too much, now I'm not denying that there are people out there, obviously, that have spending problems or that have actual illness around how they spend or how they gamble or that sort of thing. I'm not saying that that doesn't occur. But I'm saying even in those families, often they're on the wrong subject. Instead of dealing with the illness or the symptom, they end up talking about what it means to them. You don't care about me. You don't care if we were broke. You never listen to me, etc. All kinds of stuff that have nothing to do with the business of protecting us financially.
Mm-hmm. And so your technique for helping them sort that out is to ask them specific questions about what they say the complaint is.
Right, exactly. Specific questions. And part of the overarching goal in all of this is to try to get them curious about them.
Mm-hmm.
I have a little chart that I use in my groups. It describes every single marital fight. I've had people clip this out and put it on their refrigerators. And all it shows up is a square box in which in the far left corner, somebody says, I need. And the next step, the other partner says, I can't. And they immediately drop into a reptilian mode of, it's not that you can't, that you won't. There's something wrong with you, there's something wrong with me, or there's something wrong with us.
Mm.
When a person's attacked in that way, the fourth corner of the box then is simply, you want too much. Nothing I do is enough. It's at those bottom two boxes where people feel hopeless. And by definition, in my view, they're in the reptilian brain. And what they can't do in that state is they can't be curious about each other. They can't say, why don't you want to save money with me, or do we have different goals? And you can put literally any argument onto this little square, and people can walk right through it. Show that, you know, for example, I need more sex. You never want to have sex with me. And the other person says, I can't. I'm too whatever. I'm stressed out. If they can stay at that level of, oh my gosh, it's stress. Let's work on stress. Let's work on what we really want from each other and be curious about each other, that's neocortex. That's high brain functioning. If they go right to, you're lying, you just think I'm too fat, you don't care about me, and then nothing I ever do is good enough for you, then they're in battle mode and they're having a non-discussion.
So from I need to I can't to you won't, and what's the fourth one? What's the label for the fourth one?
The fourth one is you want too much.
You want too much, so feeling overwhelmed by the demand, like you're not capable of meeting it.
Right, exactly. The subtitle to both of the bottom boxes is, you're bad. or I'm bad, or we're bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That state of badness. And so when I say that people are having the wrong discussion, often they've drifted down into immediately talking about which one of them is bad or what's wrong with us,
mm-hmm.
which by its nature does not allow them to be curious about what they really want from each other.
And what they need to do is?
What they need to do is, first of all, install safety into their discussions so that they, in whatever way they can help each other reduce tension. And that comes about through structured meetings, perhaps, writing notes to each other. One of the things about this is it's very individual, and I encourage couples to really think about really what calms them the most. Do they need to take a break and take a hot shower in the middle of a discussion? Some
mm-hmm.
couples, for example, will say, well, we take 5-minute breaks. Well, the problem with that is the clearest sign that you're not going to be able to talk to each other is a heart rate of over 100 beats per minute.
Mm-hmm.
But we now know that it takes about 30 minutes to get your heart rate down once it's up there. And so a 5-minute break often doesn't work at all. It's not bad. It might break up the rhythm, but it might not be sufficient. So do you need to take a hot shower? Do you need to reschedule a meeting?
Mm-hmm.
Also, they need to identify minimal tasks or minimal agreements that would make them feel better. So, for example, in a half hour, they're not going to define their entire financial strategy. But they might be able to say, look, I'm taking you seriously, I'm not blowing you off, and I promise I won't spend over $100 for the next month without talking to you. Or maybe make it only 2 weeks. What I find is that people can agree to almost anything if there's a time limit on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's when they think you're telling them that they have to change for the rest of their lives that they actually dig in their heels.
Mm-hmm.
So we look for minimal kinds of agreements. And then as they are building in this safety and testing it, because all of this requires a great deal of trust, obviously. If I'm going to not spend money for the next 2 weeks, I need to know that you're not going to call your attorney or do something to me that I don't like for the next 2 weeks. I've had couples where for the first 2 weeks, all they could agree to is that he wouldn't call her that name and she wouldn't mention his mother. And that was fine. That's a fine agreement. And what you find is that when people can agree to these little tiny things, in business you'd call it good faith bargaining, when they can agree to these little tiny bits of contract, they feel better. They go, oh, yeah, he did that. He's serious about our relationship. Okay, now we can try something else.
Okay, so starting off small and achievable is a way to build trust and comfort.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great.
It's so important because the primitive brain is going to be saying, no, you need big answers. You need guarantees or you need a divorce, one of the two. And that brain is always going to get you into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I used the example of this being like a business approach, and often people can look at this initially and say, my gosh, that sounds boring, it sounds mechanical, where's the passion in that? It's absolutely meant to be boring and mechanical initially. What you find then, though, is that as people build a sense of trust and they have a bit of predictability, they actually can be very passionate, they can be very noisy with each other, they can challenge each other regarding sex and children and all kinds of things, because they're doing it from a position of strength as opposed to a position of fear.
Well, they can have arguments instead of fights.
Exactly, exactly. They can be clear with each other and have some sense that it's not going to lead to disaster. As an example, I had a couple that had both been arrested in an argument. And they were very prominent people, and it was a very bad situation. And during the course of treatment, they started talking about that the guy liked to sit in the basement surrounded by his collection of newspapers and magazines and smoke. And they would get into just huge fights about this habit of his, where he would go down there and have cigarettes and sit around all this paper. And it really actually did sound dangerous. And at one point, he actually kind of gave in that, yeah, this is kind of stupid. This is kind of dangerous. I actually decided to put that on the back burner because it was really distracting them from this major issue that had gotten them actually arrested. And so I put it on the back burner, but I kind of got him to agree at one point that, yeah, this may be a little risky and you've got kids, so maybe you shouldn't be doing this, but let's go back to that at a later date. And sure enough, within a week, he'd stopped doing it. You know, sometimes you have to get little agreements, you have to let each other know where things are, and then just drop them for a bit of time.
So making conscious choices to stay within the comfort level, stay with
exactly.
what's achievable and workable and productive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In my experience, something that happens kind of often is that one person in the partnership will be more willing and able to go inside, to stay on their side of the fence, to do the inside work, than the other has the skills to do at that time. And anything could happen. The other person might resonate and entrain with the person who has the greatest skill and strength, or else they might be very, very threatened, and it really gets kind of scary and hairy.
Right.
What do you think about that?
You're right, and most couples, when you get right down to it, I don't think I've ever seen a couple where they were evenly matched. And quite often, as you know, women are more verbal than men, and are a little bit more fleet of foot, and so often men, and this is stereotyping because it's not always the case, but quite often they will be more trying to flee. What I've found, though, is that you can play to both strengths, and I've also worked with individuals where the partner would not come in. And yet we were able to really look at what does the partner need. And what you're looking there is, instead of saying, what do I want to change in my partner, you're looking for what is my partner really looking for. And again, in business, you would call this, where's your leverage? What does my partner really fear most? What do they really want? And often I've worked with people where I've just coached them through language that was non-offensive, non-attacking, and really aimed at what can we do to best help our relationship, and rephrasing that in a lot of different ways so that the partner was most likely to hear it. If the partner is an attorney, I might use law language. I might say, oh, you know, you know how to do this because you do it in the courtroom. If the person's from a business background, in other words, looking for language that they can hear that isn't about, well, you're a failure as a husband, so here's what we need to do to you.
So I'm hearing two things. I'm hearing playing to the strength,
yeah,
and creating comfort and security for the partner. What does the partner need to be more comfortable? Because you know that once they're activated, then you're going to have a fight on your hands.
Right. Many of us were never raised very well to ask for what we need. We're just not very good at it. And a lot of times couples, and this is where the coaching comes in, I've heard many partners say, well, when I get home, I'm going to ask my partner this. And I'll go, oh, my God. That's going to start a fight for sure. We'll see partners that will start off a difficult discussion by saying, you're probably not going to want to talk about this, for example. Well, you know what? By the time they say you're probably not, they're absolutely right. The partner's not going to want to talk about it. Their heart rate has already gone up. And so this work has a lot to do with John Gottman's work, who talks about soft startups and finding ways to introduce language, including your own need, that is not attacking and not defensive, and you're not trying to prove you deserve to have it, but just assuming, here's what I'd like to have from you.
Yeah. Another point, I think, is that when you know you're down there in the mud and everything is very hot, you can get support elsewhere. You don't need to get that thing from your partner necessarily that at that time you're probably not going to get.
Right. Or you may be able to get something from your partner that is parallel, that would still be very reassuring and might be, again, I'm thinking of playing to their strengths. I had a couple where the wife was very insistent that the husband should always talk to her while making full eye contact. Well, men biologically make less eye contact than women, and he could do this. He could obey orders, but it actually made him more anxious, and then he didn't want to talk to her. What we found is that if he touched her, if he would touch her arm while he talked to her, she felt very much in contact with him, and the whole who's making more eye contact thing kind of went away. So actually, touch was more important, but she, from her background, eye contact told her, that's how I feel loved. Once they break through some of those showdowns where they suddenly realize, oh, there's lots of ways to feel loved, then they are more able to give each other a lot of what they want.
And what strikes me is that the same principle you were talking about earlier, that if it's something small and achievable that you ask for, then that'll help your partner feel comfortable instead of asking for something humongous that they feel overwhelmed about meeting.
Right. Because it's a reptilian state, couples fight in a rhythmic fashion. I often say that once couples have been together for a while, on their regular fights, they don't even need each other. They both know the lines so well that they can have the fight in their car alone. There's a rhythm to it. And you can almost tap your foot how the phrases are going to fall. So a lot of what you're doing is simply trying to break up the rhythm. Just do something a little different.
Mm.
Let me give you an example of that, by the way, while I'm on that. If I had one piece of advice to give every couple, and I, you know, only had a couple of minutes to talk to them, I would get them to focus on that time in the evening when they first see each other at the end of the day. And I would get them to alter that in some tiny little way. First of all, do they talk to each other when they walk in the door? Do they touch each other? Do they hug? Is there something that they do differently right then? Because if that starts off badly, the rest of the evening probably isn't going to get that much better.
Mm.
And in terms of how to get the brain to switch gears, I've even suggested to some couples they should try to say something to each other in the evening when they walk in the door immediately in a foreign language. Doesn't matter what it is. They can say, Buenos dias, doesn't matter what it is, but it'll just force them to play a little bit with language.
Mm. Excellent suggestion. Thank you.
One of the things I did do in the book, because it's trying to get people to divert over into their neocortex, one of the things that does that is humor. So I tried to tell a lot of stories in the book and jokes. Now, I've had a couple of men come in and tell me, well, I didn't really read the book. I just skipped through and looked at all the jokes. That's fine. A little osmosis might have taken place.
Some things, once you say them, really destroy a relationship. So what I do is I try to rehearse what I'm going to say. And what amazes me is that in my bathroom or my car, I'll just go berserko. I'm having just a very intelligent conversation, like you'd be rehearsing a play. And then from out of nowhere, I'm realizing now this reptilian brain explodes.
Right.
You did it to yourself.
People are looking at me in the car like I'm a lunatic, and it's like The Exorcist, and I'm thinking, where did this come from? What's wrong with me? And I'm very controlled because I don't want to go to that place that does not solve any problems. But it's there.
Yeah, it's there, and it's very deep, and I think couples are often stunned. It's interesting that you bring that up, that you do it to yourself, because we all rev yourself up thinking about some of these things. They're learned very deeply in the brain. As I said before, trauma and early learning is learned very deeply in the brain. And so what we know about that is it's learned in a part of the brain that doesn't have a clock or a calendar in it either.
Mm.
So the fight you're having right now is exactly the same fight you had last week, and it's the fight you had 6 months ago, and it's the fight you had with your parents when you were a child.
Yeah. Hey, Don, what do you think about that as an intervention, rehearsing before you have the discussion? Do you think that's helpful?
Yeah, I think it is, and I do it with like I say, with individuals, or I'll work with individuals in front of their partner sometimes about how their language goes, and really try to get them also to look at ways in which they think they may be saying something very benign, something very easygoing, or even humorous, and that comes across vicious.
Mm.
And it's for exactly the reason the caller mentioned, that something's kicking around back there that they're not even fully aware of.
Yeah.
So I think the practicing and maybe even running it by somebody else is not a bad idea at all.
Hmm.
I think once people have gained a little trust with each other, they can also be a little braver about testing it out with each other.
This has been an outstanding seminar, and our time is up. And if you'd like to get in touch with Don or check out his book or more information about him and his work, go to www.reptilesinlove.com. And you are participating in our monthly Conscious Relationship Seminar Series. I'm David Steele, founder of Relationship Coaching Institute. And you can check out our resources for singles and couples. We got free audio programs. All of these programs are recorded and available to you. So go to www.consciousrelationshipresources.com to check that out. So thanks for joining us, and we will see you next month.